Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the insurgent, or just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
Yeah, I'll get it there. Just right, yeah. Send it to that P.O. box and we all set. It's Terrible Tommy here in the bunker here on May the 25th. Actually, it's Sun's Day. Yeah, Sun's Day. I didn't send you a show yesterday, but I figured I better get down here and put one together for today. May not be the best show, but it may be the best show. You never know. So anyhow. It's a beautiful here. I've never seen it much more beautiful weather here in the Midwest right now. So, and my yard's all mowed and my weeds are all pulled and we're all set. So here we go. Now here's something I've been promoting with people for a long time, and that's the works of Lysander Spooner, who had an essay on trial by jury, in which he shows how you can nullify a jury just like O.J. Simpson's jury did in Los Angeles several years ago. Everybody went, oh my, well, that's what the jury can do. The jury doesn't have to listen to any instructions of the judge. They can just come back and say not guilty or guilty. Anyhow, so there was a little piece of this on the internet last night. I picked it up and I'm going to play it for you. Now, this is primarily probably directed towards poor blacks and things like that, but the mop flops either way.
The whole community, there are customs and moral codes which guide your actions. What social controls affect you?
So now we have this bizarre, weird, secret power. Trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
The risk is people get away with murder.
I'm Shannon Heffernan, and this is Life of the Law. Paul Butler grew up in a black neighborhood on the south side of Chicago. He was a smart, talented kid and ended up going to Harvard Law School. When he graduated, he wanted to do something for communities like the one he grew up in. Black communities were besieged by crime, so he became a prosecutor.
So I thought, I'm going to go in as this undercover brother, and I'm going to make a difference from the inside.
But as a prosecutor, Butler had to put a lot of people behind bars.
And it turned out that I was kind of good at that. You know, I was like this, you know, this clean-cut black guy, and most of the jurors in D.C. were black, and they would just beam at me when I said, my name's Paul Butler, I represent the government. They'd almost do whatever I wanted.
Almost. Except when it came to petty drug cases. Even when it was very clear someone was guilty, juries came back with an innocent verdict. Butler was confused. Why would they let someone they knew was guilty of a drug charge go free? Then, one day, he's prosecuting one of these cases.
And the defense was something like, well, yeah, the police caught me with the drugs, but they weren't mine. And you know, I was like, okay. You know, for the law, it actually doesn't matter. If the drugs are on you, it's what's called a strict liability crime, so you're guilty. So the judge told that to the jurors. Jury went out, they deliberated, and they came back with a big fat not guilty. I was like, oh my God, what's up? So I was right out there outside the jury, the room where they come out, and none of the black jurors would talk to me. And the white woman stopped for a moment, and I said, what happened? And she said, we all knew he was guilty. But he's so young.
Even if the jurors thought the boy was too young, the law was still the law. Butler asked the more experienced prosecutors what was going on. It turned out it had a name, jury nullification. When a jury nullifies, it finds a defendant innocent, although the jurors may actually believe he's guilty. And because it's illegal to retry someone, the person goes free. The prosecutors Butler talked to hated it. They thought it weakened the legal system. But nullification has played a big role in American history. Jurors used it all the way back during the Revolutionary War to free Americans who spoke out against the British, and during Prohibition to keep bootleggers out of jail. Most famously, it was used during slavery.
Imagine you were a juror in 1850, and it was against the law to help a slave run away. And so jurors would often say, not guilty, even though these folks were 100% guilty. By the way, those jurors also helped create the conditions that led to the abolition of slavery. And I ask folks now, well, what would you do?
It seems like an easy answer. Slavery is wrong. But jury nullification has a dark side, too.
I don't think anyone could really advocate for a system where the juries can do whatever they want to do.
Jeff Kramer is a managing director of Kroll Investigations and has tried at least 100 jury trials. Kramer says juries have used nullification to do things we look back on as being right, but they've also used nullification to do things that were really wrong.
Butler was so badly damaged that we couldn't hardly just tell who he was, but he happened to have on a ring with his initials.
In August of 1955, two white men killed Emmett Till, a black 14-year-old who they said whistled at a white woman.
We never have any trouble until some of our southern niggas go up north and the NAACP talks to them and they come back home. I'd like for the NAACP to know that we are here giving all parties a fair and impartial trial.
The trial was not fair. The evidence was clear. Later, the two white defendants would even admit to the murder. But the all-white jury found the white defendants innocent. That was nullification, too. Again, Jeff Kramer.
The risk is people get away with murder. And they get away with murder because the jury in those cases regarded the defendants as more valuable than the victims. So if we allowed jury nullification, system's over. It doesn't work. It's broken.
There is nobody who will tell you that the jurors are anything but serious and impressed with the magnitude of the task that they've been given.
Sherry Diamond is a professor at Northwestern Law School. Jury deliberation is usually very private, but Diamond received rare permission to study them in action. Her conclusion? Nullification doesn't happen often.
The jurors will say, boy, I sure don't agree with that law, but we have no choice.
Of course, juries are a cross-section of society with all its flaws. But Diamond says you have to remember that in order to be on a jury, you have to first get through the selection process. That weeds out people with biases, people who might nullify.
So the jury is us, but perhaps a better us.
That better us will nullify in rare circumstances, usually when our accepted morals don't match the letter of the law.
One way of saying it is that this is a kind of safety valve for the system, and we tolerate it, and there are, in fact, court opinions that say specifically that the jury has no right to do it. But, of course, we structurally build a system in which the jury has the power to do it.
Jury nullification dates all the way back to common law. It was designed as a check and balance on the government's power. Paul Butler, the prosecutor who was having trouble getting guilty verdicts, thinks it may be the most direct form of democracy we have. 12 people in a room charged with coming to a single conclusion. He left the prosecutor's office and became a professor at George Washington University. He now believes those jurors who nullified in all those drug cases were onto something.
There are more blacks who are under criminal justice supervision now than there were slaves in 1850.
Butler thinks drug laws are to blame for those high incarceration numbers. Statistically, there are less black drug users, but more blacks in prison for drugs. So just like jurors nullified the fugitive slave laws, Butler thinks modern jurors should nullify drug laws.
sometimes the law really is unfair, and sometimes jurors really should say that people are not guilty, even if they committed the crime, especially if it's a drug case, because the drug laws are selectively enforced, and I don't think it's fair.
Now, despite the role nullification can play, chances are you haven't heard of it, and there's a reason for that. Most people in the legal system think juries shouldn't nullify. It's too dangerous. Still, they can't take away jurors' ability to nullify without taking away other basic rights enshrined in the Constitution. But there are three ways the legal system tries to discourage nullification. First, as a juror, you take an oath.
Do each of you solemnly swear that you will render a true verdict according to the law and the evidence, so help you God?
Second, defense lawyers cannot tell jurors to nullify. They can only raise doubts that their client didn't commit the crime.
Members of the jury, these are the facts. And I am confident today you will see this case is full of reasonable doubts.
Third, most judges basically tell you not to nullify.
It is your responsibility to decide what the facts of this case may be and to apply the law to those facts.
So, juries may be able to nullify, but the system is set up to hide that.
So now we have this bizarre, weird, secret power that one of my functions is, if the trial judge doesn't have to tell you about it, then I sure can.
Butler tries to spread the word about nullification through speaking and writing. Another activist takes a more direct approach.
Oh, I'm Julian Heiklin. And I am the biggest pain in the ass in the world.
Heiklin is a member of the Fully Informed Jury Association. Their goal is to make sure jurors know they can nullify. Heiklin stands outside courtrooms, handing out literature and talking to people. He thinks nullification is a good strategy for all kinds of laws he sees as being unfair, including gun laws. In August of 2011, the U.S. government charged Heiklin with jury tampering, a serious offense. The case got a lot of attention, especially when the judge denied Heiklin a jury trial. After all, it would be just another opportunity for him to tell jurors how to nullify. But if the courts want to keep this jury nullification thing on the down low, then Heiklin says the joke has been on them.
So they've made a national issue out of this. They've done something that I could have never done by myself. This is all over the country. All of a sudden, I've become a major public figure, and I'm just a shabby old man with a few ridiculous pamphlets.
They're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Of course, they're handing out the biggest pamphlet ever.
Since I spoke with Heiklin, the case has been dropped. He plans to be outside courtrooms again soon, for better or worse, making the secret power of nullification a little less secret. Life of the Law is produced by Nancy Mullane and myself, Shannon Heffernan.
So now you know if you've got enough people thinking the right way on the jury, you can make anybody innocent and they can walk out free man or free woman just by jury nullification. Now next, we're going to go to Nuremberg. And I'm not sure whether I sent you this before or not. It's about a minister who was ministering to the prisoners there at Nuremberg. Now we can forget all his church stuff because there's a lot of interesting little tidbits in here that probably most people have never heard of. And so this fellow's written this book and a lot of interesting stuff about some of the Third Reich prisoners at Nuremberg comes out. Here we go.
Thank you first to Left Bank for having me. It's obviously a great bookstore, and I spent a lot of time at Left Bank when I lived here. So thank you very much for hosting this event. I also want to just thank, first and foremost, my colleagues from the Post-Dispatch who are here. And who are my friends and have supported me for a long time when I wrote this book, for the 6 years that I wrote this book, and for the last 2 weeks since its publication. So appropriately, because they're journalists, they're all in the back drinking, but thank you, guys. And thank you also to the sort of celebrity in the audience. This is a book about Henry Garrickey, Chaplain Henry Garrickey, and his son, Colonel Hank Garrickey, came up from Cape Girardeau to be here tonight. He's in the front, and I hope he's going to say a few words in a little bit. Hank was my collaborator in every way on this book. I spent a lot of time at his kitchen table with he and his wife, Millie, learning about his father and his mother and their upbringing in St. Louis. So for those two reasons, this is a very meaningful and special night for me. So thank you both collectively and individually. Okay. We're good. So Friday, June 14th, 1946, was day 155 of the trial of the major war criminals, more commonly now referred to simply as the Nuremberg Trials. Though no one in courtroom 600 in Nuremberg's Palace of Justice knew it yet, the trial was about halfway over. On day 155, Franz von Papen, Hitler's former chancellor, was on the witness stand. As he testified, the Third Reich's radio propaganda chief, Hans Fritzsche, a sub-lieutenant of Joseph Goebbels, wrote a letter which Baldur von Schirach, the former leader of the Hitler Youth Movement, then translated into English. It was addressed to Mrs. Alma Garrickey of 3204 Halliday Avenue in South St. Louis. Holding Nazi leaders accountable for World War II was an experiment. At the time, there was no legal precedent for framing criminal charges against the perpetrators of a war of aggression. As early as 1944, Allied leaders were hashing out the best way to punish people whose criminal activities were so horrendous that laws barring them didn't technically exist. Nuremberg was an improvisation. Never before had the international community held a state's major leaders accused and convicted them of conspiring to commit crimes against humanity. The trial of the major war criminals was, in the words of one of its American prosecutors, quote, a benchmark in international law and the lodestar of thought and debate on the great moral and legal questions of war and peace, end quote. Existing within the larger Nuremberg improvisation was another that has never been told in full. It is a historical asterisk to what was called the trial of the century. It was an experiment in how good confronts radical evil. And at its center was a farm kid from Missouri. Those organized trials knew that if they were going to try some of the world's most notorious criminals for war crimes, they also had to follow the Geneva Conventions. Article 16 of the Convention's regulations regards the treatment of prisoners of war and states that prisoners of war are permitted, quote, complete freedom in the performance of their religious duties, including attendance at the services of their faith. Ministers of religion who are prisoners of war, whatever may be their denomination, shall be allowed freely to minister to their co-religionists. But Nuremberg was not the average POW camp. The world was watching as Hitler's deputies answered for the Holocaust. The Allies didn't trust Wehrmacht chaplains to do the job, so they brought in two of their own instead. Chaplain Henry Garrickey of St. Louis and Chaplain Sixtus O'Connor of Oxford, New York. For the first time in history, U.S. Army chaplains would minister to the enemy. And the enemy included some of the 20th century's most infamous names. Hermann Göring,
Hitler's number two, commander of Germany's air force, the Luftwaffe, and the force behind the Third Reich's final solution. Albert Speer, Hitler's architect and the Reich's armaments minister, who took advantage of concentration camp labor in places like Mauthausen to mine granite used in Germany's grand building plans. General Wilhelm Keitel, field marshal and second only to Hitler in Germany's military hierarchy. Fritz Sauckel, the Reich's labor minister in charge of what one historian has called, quote, the greatest slave roundup in history, end quote, which included, by the end of 1942, 4.5 million foreign workers. And Hans Frank, Hitler's personal lawyer and eventually the governor general of Poland, where he earned nicknames such as Slayer of the Poles and the Butcher of Krakow. On that Friday in June 1946, von Papen testified in courtroom 600. Fritzscher wrote the letter to Alma Gericke. When he finished, all 21 of the Nazi prisoners, including the Catholics and those who had refused any spiritual counsel, signed it. It read in part, "Your husband, Pastor Gericke, has been taking religious care of the undersigned defendants during the Nuremberg trial. He has been doing so for more than half a year. We now have heard, dear Mrs. Gericke, that you wish to see him back home after his absence of several years. Because we also have wives and children, we understand this wish of yours very well. Our dear Chaplain Gericke is necessary for us, not only as a minister, but also as the thoroughly good man that he is. Surely we need not describe him as such to his own wife. We simply have come to love him." In the fall of 2007, I was writing a story for the newspaper right down the street, the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, where I covered the religion beat. The story was about Operation Barnabas, a program that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod had recently begun to help chaplains who were returning from Iraq and Afghanistan more smoothly re-enter their congregations back home. But I needed some color for the story. So I went to Concordia Seminary in Clayton. The school's historical institute happened to have an exhibition on the history of the American military chaplaincy at the time. Under one of those pieces of glass was a letter to Alma Gericke from the Nazis. I read that word love just above the signatures of the perpetrators of a genocide, and I thought, huh, that could be a story. I found Gericke's eldest son, Hank Gericke, in Cape Girardeau, and I sat at his kitchen table and he told me the story of his father and mother. And 6 years later, here we are. Hank and his younger brother, Corky, were already in uniform in 1943 when their father raised his hand and said he'd like to be a war chaplain. The first part of Gericke's career had been spent pastoring a church in South St. Louis. Then, during the Depression, he had been a missioner with the St. Louis Lutheran City Mission, traveling the broken city and ministering to those on the streets, in hospitals and in city jails. Now he wanted to do his part for the war effort. He was 50 years old. The Army assigned Gericke to the 98th General Hospital, which in 1944 landed in Hermitage, about 60 miles west of London, in the south of England. There, the 98th set up a 1,000-plus bed transit hospital, where doctors and nurses would literally just stop the bleeding as wounded GIs were flown in from the front lines in Europe before putting them on a train to larger hospitals in London. When the war was over, the 98th was sent to Germany to take over a bombed-out hospital in Munich. In the fall of 1945, Colonel Burton Andrus, the commandant of the Nuremberg prison, heard about a Lutheran chaplain in Munich who could speak German and who had ministered to men in the St. Louis City jail system. Gericke was given the assignment, but he was also given the chance to turn it down. Gericke prayed hard about the decision. He asked himself, how could a preacher from St. Louis make any impression on the disciples of Adolf Hitler? During his months in Munich, Gehrke had taken several trips to Dachau. He'd seen the raw aftermath of the Holocaust. He returned to his commanding officer. "I'll go," he said. Gehrke wasn't the only chaplain at Nuremberg. The assistant chaplain was a Franciscan friar from upstate New York. Father Sixtus O'Connor had been a chaplain with the 11th Armored Division, known as the Thunderbolt, during the war. The 11th fought in the Battle of the Bulge and moved east over the winter of 1944 and 45. O'Connor earned a Bronze Star for ministering during combat to men suffering from what the Army then called battle fatigue. In May 1945, the 11th helped liberate Mauthausen concentration camp outside Hitler's hometown of Linz, Austria, where nearly 100,000 people were tortured and murdered between 1939 and 1945. This is a photo of what were called the Stairs of Death at Mauthausen. They led down the Wienergraben granite quarry, owned by an SS company called the German Earth and Stone Works. Albert Speer contracted with the quarry to supply granite for his great visions of Nazi buildings and monuments, many of them in Nuremberg. The 186 steps to the quarry floor were badly cut into the clay and slippery. When prisoners reached the bottom of the steps, they strapped massive granite slabs on their backs and were then sent up the stairway of death. When a man reached the top, seen here in a photo after liberation, an SS guard may have directed him to throw the slab from the top of the sheared quarry wall, 12 stories high, back down to the bottom of the pit, then demand he run down and bring the same boulder back up to the top. Throwing prisoners 12 stories to their deaths below was also a cheap, effective murder method for the guards. The SS called the victims of such murder parachutists. Mauthausen held 66,500 prisoners on May 4, 1945, the day before it was liberated by the 11th Armored Division and other units. More than 450 died each day during the following week. Father O'Connor buried 2,911 people between May 8 and May 31. This is a photo of Ernst Kaltenbrunner on the far right during an inspection of Mauthausen in 1941. With Heinrich Himmler on the left and the camp's commandant in the middle. Kaltenbrunner was the head of the Reich Security Main Office and controlled the Gestapo, the SD, or Security Police, Security Service, and the Security Police. He had authority over the Einsatzgruppen units that roamed Eastern Europe, killing as many Jews as they could find. And, as Adolf Eichmann's superior, he was responsible for the administrative apparatus behind the entire concentration and extermination camp system. 3 months after helping to liberate Mauthausen, Father O'Connor was in Nuremberg ministering to Ernst Kaltenbrunner. This is a promotional shot taken by the Army of Gehrke in 1946 in a 169-square-foot chapel in the Nuremberg prison, made by knocking down the wall between two cells. The chaplains outfitted it with chairs as pews, an altar, some candles, and a small organ. It was in this chapel that Gehrke and O'Connor believed they'd been successful in their mission, to bring as many of the imprisoned Nazis back to Christianity as they could before escorting them to the gallows. It was in this chapel that they celebrated Christmas Eve worship services with men who had murdered millions. Both chaplains would return home immediately after the executions and continue their ministries in different ways. O'Connor returned to teaching philosophy in upstate New York. Gehrke continued to try and reach people most would simply consider evil and unworthy of contemplation, murderers and rapists incarcerated in a maximum security prison in Chester, Illinois. Few people believe themselves to be capable of extraordinary human evil perpetrated by the Nazis. And the inability to comprehend how the Holocaust occurred has reassured or comforted millions since the Second World War. Philosopher Arne Vettelsen has written that, quote, "It helps us It helps side us, normal men, as we take ourselves to be against the doers, the Nazi perpetrators. The doers, we like to think, are not like us. Indeed, their being unlike us is the very quality which explains that they could do what they did, having committed atrocities so outrageous in nature and scope as to explode our faculties of comprehension. They, authors of the unthinkable, must surely be or have been abnormal men. End quote. To think this way, however, is to turn away from what the Holocaust means, to refuse to fully acknowledge its scope and what it says about the human condition. It is, wrote Vettelsen, to help perpetuate the very conditions which made its occurrence a historical fact in the first place. Does attempting to understand human evil create a path toward justifying or excusing the behavior that creates evil? If the perpetrators of genocide can be seen as fellow human beings, do they deserve empathy or even forgiveness from those of us who choose to lead good lives? Theologians have argued that the existence of moral evil in humans is the corollary to free will. In a theology that holds there is only one all-powerful God who bestowed humans with free will, must God in some way be responsible for mass annihilation? The medieval Christian philosopher and theologian St. Augustine said that, quote, either God cannot abolish evil or he will not. If he cannot, he is not all-powerful. If he will not, he is not all-good. If God creates evil, but also allows his creation free will, is God or man responsible for the Holocaust? If God is master of both absolute good and absolute evil, he must also claim those of us who choose darkness. And what about forgiveness? A theological point on which Christian and Jews differ. Christian tradition has consistently said that forgiveness precedes repentance. Christians believe God, through the crucifixion of Jesus, has already accepted and forgiven them. Broadly, forgiveness in Judaism has two working parts at extreme opposite ends of the good-evil spectrum, desisting from the evil act and then doing good. Jews who survived the Holocaust and later generations of Jews have no moral standing to forgive the perpetrators of the Holocaust. What right does anyone other than those who died in the Holocaust have to forgive anyone for having created or participated in it? Only the murdered could forgive, and that can't happen. So the Christian concept of forgiveness must be strained by the idea of genocide. Could Christians really believe that their God was crucified to forgive those who conceived of the gas showers at Auschwitz or the parachutist jump into the quarry at Mauthausen? Because the majority of the Holocaust victims were Jewish, it would seem right that the Allies should have honored the Jewish sensibilities about forgiveness. But Christians like Garricky and O'Connor would argue that they had to act toward the Nazis in their flocks in ways that honored their deepest understanding of humanity and its relationship with God. The chaplains believed that their duties toward the Nazis revolved around how to return them to the good. Even though Nazi war criminals had committed a different kind of wrong than ordinary people do, Garricky would not have seen the monsters he pastored at Nuremberg as children of darkness. Without forgiving the deeds of those responsible for wiping out 6 million Jews, by the nature of their faith in God, Garricky and O'Connor saw these men as part of a single human community. Once they recognized the men in Nuremberg as just men, ministering to them, despite the horrors they'd executed, became a matter of attempting a transformation. The Nuremberg chaplains' one single burden was to return mass murderers from darkness to the good of their own light. So I'm just going to read a little bit of one chapter. The morning after the executions, Andrus had summoned Garricky and O'Connor to his office. He told them that the condemned men would be awakened at 11:45 p.m., served a last meal, and then walked to the gym. The executions would begin just after midnight. Andrus had ordered the chaplains not to tell the men, nor anyone else, of the execution plans. They shouldn't know until they were woken up that night, he had told them. The day should proceed normally. In the afternoon, as the chaplains visited the men's cells, O'Connor asked Kaltenbrunner, Frank, and Sazenquart whether they would like to confess their sins and receive communion. Their eyes grew large as they realized why he was asking. What did he know, they demanded. Would it happen at dawn tomorrow? O'Connor told them he hadn't heard anything. Garricky sat with each of the six condemned men in his charge, Goring, Keitel, Ribbentrop, Rosenberg, Sokol, and Frick, and delivered a copy of a devotion he'd written in German for them. He asked them each to join him in a prayer he'd also written. Only Rosenberg refused. No, please do not, he said to Garricky. Goring demanded to know what was going on with the execution timetable. He was also refusing to leave his cell, and he was adamantly against exercising and showering. He took all the family photos that had decorated his flimsy table and put them in an envelope for his attorney. In the early afternoon, Goring requested a visit from Garricky. What time are the executions scheduled for, Pastor? Goring asked. Garricky didn't answer. The Reichsmarshal was a likable man, and Garricky wished he could have been honest with him. Even Chaplain Carl Eggers, who hadn't known Goring for as long as Garricky, called him, quote, a good-natured charmer, end quote, with a, quote, good sense of humor. Eggers had been surprised that Goring also knew quite a bit about the Bible. Of all the doomed men, he impressed us the most, O'Connor said later. You felt that with his brain, he could have accomplished a lot. Goring had been fascinated with baseball, and he often discussed the game with O'Connor during his routine visits. He wanted to know about the Dodgers and how baseball worked as a business. Is there money in it? Goring would ask. O'Connor told him that Branch Rickey, the Dodgers' general manager, made $90,000 a year. Maybe I should have gone into that business, Goring had said. It was mid-October, and an ocean away, Garricky's St. Louis Cardinals were battling the Boston Red Sox in the World Series. Though he was from upstate New York and really a Dodgers fan, O'Connor had taken Boston in a $10 bet with Garricky. In between visiting the prisoners in their cells that day, the chaplains hurried to the guards' booth on the prison floor to get a score. With the Palace of Justice locked down for the executions, the only way the chaplains and guards had of receiving updates after each half inning was through a phone call from an American officer. Around 7:30 p.m., Garricky returned to Goring's cell in a final attempt to get him to accept Christ. Goring had been a regular at the prison chapel, but he had resisted Garricky's efforts to bring him more seriously into the folds of the church. Garricky told Goring he'd written a special devotional for him. Goring told the chaplain to leave it on his table. He'd read it later. What he really wanted to discuss was the executions. Garricky tried again to steer the conversation toward how a man prepares his soul for death. He asked Goring to join him in a prayer. No, Goring said. He would watch Garricky pray from his cot. Garricky thought Goring seemed more depressed than he had earlier, which was not surprising given what was coming. Goring asked how the other men were doing. In particular, he was concerned about Sokol, whom he could hear crying and moaning with fear. He asked Garricky if he might be able to see Sokol to help him get through this. Then he started in again on the method of execution. Hanging, Goring said, was a most dishonorable way for him to die, given his former position with the German people. Garricky didn't respond. He'd heard the same complaint dozens of times from Goring since the sentencing. Silence fell between them. Somewhat desperately now, Garricky tried one last time to engage Goring on, quote, the eternal values of how a man can be prepared to die to meet his God, end quote. Surrender your heart and soul completely to your Savior, Herr Reichsmarschall, Garricky said. But Goering was in no mood to listen. For the last time, Goering told the chaplain that he was a member of the Christian Church, but that he couldn't accept the teachings of the Christian faith. He began to make fun of the creation story in the Old Testament. He ridiculed the idea that the Bible was written by scribes, divinely inspired by God. He refused the fundamental Christian doctrine of atonement, that Jesus, through his suffering and resurrection, died for the forgiveness of man's sin and to reconcile God with his creation. Gericke pleaded with Goering. "This is what Jesus said," the chaplain said. "This isn't what Gericke is saying, but this is God speaking to you. Won't you accept this? Just say, 'Jesus, save me.'" "No," Goering barked. "I can't do that. This Jesus you always speak of, to me, he's just another smart Jew." "Herr Reichsmarschall," Gericke said, "this Jesus is my Savior who suffered, bled, and died that I may go to heaven someday. He paid for my sins." "Ach," Goering yelled, "you don't believe that yourself. When one is dead, that's the end of everything." In a softer tone, he continued, "Pastor, I believe in God. I believe he watches over the affairs of men, but only the big ones. He is too great to bother about little matters like what becomes of Hermann Goering." He fell silent for a moment, then he looked at Gericke. "Pastor," he finally said, "how do you celebrate the Lord's Supper?" Gericke was astonished. "You claim membership in the church," Gericke said. "You must be familiar with its sacraments." The Lord's Supper, the Christian sacrament of Holy Communion, was particularly meaningful for Gericke. As a Lutheran, the chaplain believed that when Christ offered bread to his apostles at the Last Supper, telling them it was his body, it actually became his body. When bread and wine were consecrated in Gericke's Lutheran church, those in the pews had been taught to believe that the body of Christ was, quote, "truly present in, with, and under," end quote, the elements of bread and wine. In Holy Communion, some Christians believe God is mitigating their suffering through the sacrifice of Christ, his Son. Their sins disappear each time they receive communion, and they grow a little closer to God. These convictions stem from Christianity's central belief in atonement. Gericke reminded Goering of the church doctrines, emphasizing that only the truly penitent should partake. He had administered communion to Keitel, Ribbentrop, Sokol, Rader, Speer, Fritzsche, and Schirach, because they had requested it and had suffered through a great deal of self-examination under Gericke's guidance. "Herr Reichsmarschall," Gericke said, "this is the way it is. Only those who believe that Jesus is really their Savior, who believe in him who instituted the supper, should be permitted to attend the Lord's Supper. The others are unfit." "I have never been refused the Lord's Supper by a German pastor," Goering said. "Never." Gericke had been afraid of this moment. A committed member of his congregation was asking for the most central sacrament of the church with his final wish. Yet Goering had just disparaged the foundations of the Christian faith. Gericke knew Goering was, like Rosenberg and many Nazis, Gottglaubig, a believer in God but not Christ. As a rationalist, Goering wanted to go through the motions, believing none of the mysteries of the church while retaining some insurance in case Christianity really represented the truth. "I cannot with a clear conscience commune you because you deny the very Christ who instituted the sacrament," Gericke said. "You may be on the church roll, but you do not have faith in Christ and have not accepted him as your Savior. Therefore, you are not a Christian, and as a Christian pastor, I cannot commune you." Gericke thought that at that moment Goering would request a German pastor, but Goering said nothing more. Defeated, Gericke left the cell and moved on. Goering read in bed for 30 minutes before getting up and walking to the toilet in the corner of his cell, out of view of his guards. He returned to his bed, took off his boots, and put on his slippers. He was agitated and restless. He picked up his book, walked to the table in his cell with it, picked up his reading glasses, and then put them down. He moved his suspenders and some writing utensils, placing them on a nearby chair. At 9:15, Goering changed into his silk pajamas and got into bed, covering his chest with his hands. His left hand kept moving between his body and the cell wall while he massaged his forehead with his right hand. As usual, the prison lights were turned down at 9:30. The cell lights dimmed and the overhead corridor lights were turned out. At 10:40, Goring turned his head to the wall and lay that way for a few minutes. Then he placed his hands at his sides again and clenched his jaw hard. Breaking the glass vial of potassium cyanide he placed in his cheeks moments before. His guard, Private Harold Johnson, saw Goring stiffen and make a blowing, choking sound through his lips. Goring began grabbing at his throat. In the guard booth nearby, the guards and chaplains had gathered for the latest World Series update from outside the prison's walls. Boston's Dom DiMaggio had doubled in the top of the eighth, driving in two runs to tie St. Louis. Garricky saw Johnson signaling that something was wrong. "Goring's having some kind of spell," he yelled. Johnson began unbolting the door as the acrid smell of bitter almonds wafted out of the cell. Garricky arrived within seconds. The chaplain pushed past Johnson and moved toward the cot. Goring, froth coming from his mouth, was, quote, gurgling into death, Garricky thought. His heart was still beating, but his eyes had rolled back in his head, and the gurgling sound continued. His right arm dangled over the side of the cot. Garricky picked up Goring's hand and felt for a pulse. "Get the doctor. This man is dying," Garricky yelled at the prison officer. Goring was turning green, and his gasping was growing fainter. His toes were beginning to curl toward the soles of his feet. Garricky leaned down to Goring's ear. "The blood of Jesus Christ cleanseth us from all our sins," he said. The prison doctor arrived, and Garricky stepped back to let him take Goring's pulse. It was fading. The doctor pulled back the blanket covering Goring to check his heart and found two white envelopes in Goring's left hand. He handed them to Garricky, telling the chaplain to remember later that he had done so. Garricky looked inside and found the cartridge case where Goring had hidden the cyanide and folded pieces of paper. By 11 o'clock, the bitter almond smell was stronger and Goring's skin had turned from green to gray. One eye was partly open and dilated. His mouth was also slightly open, and the doctor could see glass shards on Goring's tongue. Garricky turned to the chief prison officer as he arrived. "He's dead," Garricky said, and handed him the white envelopes, which were later classified top secret. One of them was addressed to the chaplain. Thank you. So I'm happy to take some questions if people have them, but before I do that, I do want to have the celebrity in the audience talk if he would like to. Hank?
I'm getting old. You did great.
Here, you want to turn around? Here, I got it right here.
Oh. This way.
That's where the people are.
Oh, my God. Look at that crowd. You got to charge admission. I'll split it with you. I want to say a word to the reporters from the Post-Dispatch. As a former chief of police, I have been a subject of several of your articles. Not all favorable, I might add, but that's part of the job. But there was a young man at Nuremberg who was a reporter for the Post-Dispatch, and one of the reports made was that my dad held Goring's hand as he died. And that distressed my father, because what he felt was to find the pulse. And he complained to the reporter, who he had been friendly with, because they're both from St. Louis, you know, that sort of thing. And the reporter said to Dad, "I'll take care of it," and he did. Now, you find the record, as I don't have it here, but there is a phone file at the Post-Dispatch, his report on Dad dealing with Goring as he died. Now, my father was criticized because he did not give Goring communion. And believe it or not, he was criticized by several Lutheran ministers. Oh, he said, they said, "You should have given him communion. He was going to die." Well, they were talking to the wrong guy. My father had principles, And one of the principles was you believe in God and you accept God's word, and there's no ifs or ands or buts about it. But Goring was a manipulator of the first order. Let me tell you a little thing about what he said to my father once on the exercise field. He said, you know, Chaplain, I'm the senior officer here, and you're going to have people come to the chapel. He says, I'll give an order to them that they'll have to attend chapel. And my father says, Herman, no, you won't. And he says, well, I know you won't. If they want to come to chapel, they'll come to chapel. Now, it wasn't all black and white with my dad. He had a sense of humor, believe me. One of the prisoners was concerned about his wife. And the wife had two boys, I think, or two girls. And he asked Dad, could he check on them, find out how they were doing and all. So my dad, through the courtesy of the intelligence people, found out where she was living. And he called on her. And he rang the doorbell, and an American captain answered the door. And Dad told me, excuse me, he says, I've got the wrong house. And the captain says, well, who were you looking for? And he addressed the man. He said, oh, I'll call her. And the lady came, and Dad talked to her for a few minutes and all. Well, he went back to the prisoner, and the prisoner said, how is my wife doing? She's doing fine, Dad said. He had a heart. He had a heart as big as a house, believe me. Now, he went to the airport several times to pick up one of the German officers' wives, one of the field marshals that they had confined there, who was there as a witness. They were being held by the Russians. She never showed up because they wouldn't release her. Now, in respect to the poison that Goring got, there is a book published by a teacher, principal of a high school in Texas, who wrote a book on the evidence is there, but not positive, that an American captain who became friends with Goring gave Goring the poison because he had access to Goring's valise in his bag. And Goring came prepared to take poison. There was no two ways about it. But, again, how do you deal with something like this? I called my dad the night of the hanging. I was in the hospital, 97th General Hospital in Frankfort, kind of beat up. I'd been in an accident. And I got put right through. I said, I'm Lieutenant Garricky, and I'd like to talk to my father, Chaplain Garricky, and put me right on through. And I talked to Dad, and I said, and I remember this very well, my prayers go out to you, and I know you've got a tough night ahead of you, Dad. Say, take care, and I'm saying a prayer for you. And you know, to this day, I find it strange that I have said those things to my father. But he thanked me. Now, things weren't all that summer with my dad. I know my daughter, my favorite nurse, is here, and she's heard me tell this story, and my niece is here, and my daughter is one of the wife of my brother. He called me the week before he went to Nuremberg, and he said, I've got a couple of days off, and I'm going to go to Paris. Can you get away to get to Paris? I said, as a matter of fact, I can. I've got to go there on a very important mission. I was a supply officer for the battalion, and my important mission was buying a class liquor supply. Now, you go ahead and laugh, but that's important. And I was entrusted with this mammoth task. Well, I got there, and I went to lunch with Dad. I went to breakfast with him, and I had dinner with him. But after dinner, I escorted him back to his hotel, and then I went out. And I was there a couple of days, and we had just finished going through the Louvre. And I said to Dad, I've got to rest. I've just got to sit down and rest. And he says, come on, son. We have a limited time here, and we have to see these things. I said, well, Dad, I'm tired. He says, come on, let's go, son. All right. Let's go forward to 1959 and 1960, Chester, Illinois. We're sitting on the back porch, and we're reminiscing about our times in London, Paris, and so forth. Quite an activity for a Lutheran preacher and his son, believe me. They're talking about visiting these cities. And I said to Dad, did you ever wonder why I was so tired and all we were talking about the Louvre? And he says, yes, he says, I knew what you were doing. And I figured if I walked you long and hard enough, you'd stop that nonsense. He didn't succeed, by the way. He didn't succeed. I adored my father. My father didn't have a pot to do it in or a window to throw it out of. But when I was leaving the army, he asked me, how much money you got? I said, a quarter. He reached in his wallet and he pulled out a folded $5 bill, and this is 1939. Now, money was tight, you know. And he said, here, take this. And I said, I can't take that. So this is his runaway money, if you want to put it that way. He said, no, I want you to have it. This was my father. He'd give you the shirt off his back. He had sympathy for the downtrodden and the poor. And he wasn't a pushover. And he got along successfully. When he died, the warden at Menard Prison called me, my mother, and he said, can we have your dad's body brought back to the prison? Because the prisoners would like to acknowledge him. I talked to my mother, and she agreed. So a hearse came, picked his body, and took it down to the prison. And 2,400 prisoners passed by, Catholics, Jews, heathens, whatever, because he was a person who could see something in men that most of us can't. And that's what when he served at Nuremberg. He was there to save their souls regardless. I adored him. Thank you. I forgot to say, if you haven't bought the book, buy it. Jim, great writer. Thank you.
A lot of reporting assignments aren't, you wouldn't call them fun. You can see why this one was. Thank you, Hank. And I should say that there are more Garrickeys here. Henry Garricky's granddaughter is here, too. So thank you to everyone for coming. It's amazing. So if anybody has questions, I'm happy to answer them. And then we can sign some books, I think. Yes. Another Garricky.
I've read it, and I could not put it down. And you did an amazing job. You really, really did.
That's my favorite kind of question. Thank you.
I have cousins in Germany who are the children and grandchildren of people who were adults during the Second World War, like me. And they teach the Holocaust every year in school from first grade on. They teach the Holocaust so that, as they say, it will never happen again. Why don't we teach it in this country?
Why don't we teach the Holocaust?
Why don't we teach about it? You can take a class in college that covers it, but most kids today don't know anything about the Holocaust.
I don't know. I'm not sure that that's true. I spent some time at the Holocaust Museum here in St. Louis, and I happened to be there once, in the spring or the fall, I can't remember when it is, but they have busloads and busloads and busloads of kids coming through. I was there once, and you could barely get in because they had so many high school and younger kids coming through it. And they've set up their museum there very specifically to be interactive so that kids get involved in it. I don't know. I don't know really enough about the education system to know if public schools are or are not teaching the Holocaust. But I would say that, especially a lot of the Jewish communities and the Holocaust museums around the country, do a pretty great job of getting kids, maybe who aren't being taught specifically about the Holocaust during World War II, but they get them to come to these museums to experience them for themselves. Yes?
Two questions. First of all, is there any similar book or writing about O'Connor? And number two, did you find any evidence that Colonel Andrus ever attempted to somehow disrupt the clergy relationship in order to get some kind of advantage or control over the prisons?
So, thank you. The question was whether there's anything been written extensively about Father O'Connor, and whether Burton Andrus, the commander, the commandant of Nuremberg, did anything to sort of scuttle some of the work that Andrus and Garrickey were doing.
Well, actually, I was thinking whether he tried to essentially turn Garrickey and O'Connor into informants.
Oh, whether he tried to turn the chaplains into informants. No, nothing has been written about Father O'Connor, mostly because he almost never talked about his entire war experience, whether it was Nuremberg or the 11th Armored, when he got home. There's very little written. I talked to one or two people who had talked to him even about it. Andrus was never tried to get in the way of the chaplains or tried to do anything to try to get them to, tell what they had learned in confession or anything that I know of. Garrickey had an interesting episode when he was in the hospital during the war. There were some German POWs in England at the time, and the intelligence services, but from the Allies, tried to get him to go into to be their pastor in order to get information from the POWs, and he refused. He refused to do it. So I don't know if it happened. I don't think it happened. Andrus was a very committed Christian. He actually attended Garrickey's. Garrickey had a church in Mogeldorf outside of Nuremberg that he pastored also, mostly for GIs or other members of the Nuremberg community, the Americans mostly. And Andrus attended his church as sort of a regular Sunday event.
I don't know if you had the same impression, but my impression reading the literature in this field is Andrus is sort of a maligned character in the sense that he's often portrayed as being some sort of martinet. The reality is he gave money to pay for Himmler's daughter's school fees, which she was going to have to leave school, although he called her that Himmler brat, and he could not bring himself to attend the executions.
That's right.
He felt emotionally, he said, I've taken care of these men for a year, I can't go and see them die.
Right. So the commandant has been sort of portrayed through history as a peacock, kind of. He was very... he wore a shellacked helmet, and he had very strict rules. And a lot of the literature that's been written about Nuremberg, and there's a lot of it, used him almost as a comic foil. And this gentleman is saying that, in fact, Andrus was a good guy. And I do have this part in the book that he refused to go to the executions because he said, no matter how much I know about these men. I spent a year with them, and I can't watch them hang. Yes.
There was a lot of testimony at the trials which described the terrible conduct of these people on trial. Did the prisoners ever express any comments or reaction to the testimony?
Not that I know of to the specifics. So the question was whether the prisoners ever expressed what was happening during the trials themselves to the chaplains.
The
testimony that they were giving and what was coming out and what their thoughts were about it. From all the reading that I did, most of that has come from books written by the psychiatrists, who were the Americans, Douglas Kelly, I can't remember the other one.
Gilbert,
thank you. Who was your dad's roommate? Gilbert was one of the psychiatrists, was Garrickey's roommate. I don't know whether, nothing that I know of has come from the chaplains themselves in that regard. Most of that, the comments about testimony and about each other's testimony comes especially from Gilbert's book. Yes.
I haven't had a chance to read your book, so I don't have a sense of all of the background. The account that you gave us of the interaction between Garing and Reverend Garrickey is extremely detailed. Were these from reminiscences of Reverend Garrickey, or how did you construct them?
Yes. The question was whether how I reconstructed that particular scene that I read and other ones like it. There are very little, but there were pieces that Garrickey wrote. He wrote a piece for the Saturday Evening Post in 1952, I think, that had two or three rough drafts, essentially, that he had written beforehand and for publication in Lutheran Army Chaplain magazines. And there is also an audio of a similar... he similarly describes his experience in, I think it's a Lions meeting or a Lutheran Ladies League meeting or something like that. But somebody in his church in Chester found an audio of him giving this kind of speech, which he did a lot of. He did a lot of touring around the Midwest and doing telling his story at small little gatherings. This one was found in the church somewhere, and they had it cleaned up, and it's on their website. So you can actually hear Garrickey himself talk about these things. So things like that, little here and there, I was able to kind of piece together into a sort of a narrative. Yes?
Pastor Garrickey, I went to the church down there, and he gave a series of speeches after he got back, and I'm sure they were recorded. But the church was just packed. I mean, people just loved him.
He was very well loved in Chester. How about in the back? Yes, sir.
How well known were the chaplain's activities during kind of post-war era, and was there any sort of negative criticism that they were providing aid and comfort to the enemy?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It was one of the sort of heartbreaks of Garrickey's post-war life. When he wrote this piece in the Saturday Evening Post, he wrote very candidly about how he met these men for the first time and that he shook. I should probably know the difference. Rudolf Hess's hand when he first met him. He describes this very emotional moment when he meets these Nazis for the first time, and the person who was escorting him was called away. So he's left alone in the prison. He'd never been there before, and now he's about to meet these people who he's so afraid of. He writes about that, and when that came out in the Saturday Evening Post, he received a lot of hate mail. A lot of people calling him an anti-Semite and a Nazi lover. People were so repulsed at that point still that anybody would even touch a Nazi that they wrote him and told him that. And after he died, Hank was going through his desk and found a secret compartment in the back of his desk, and he had kept all of this hate mail for some reason. We don't know why. But he was, during his war career, he was a chaplain to everyone, and that was very important to him. If you were Jewish, he would try to find you a rabbi. He a couple of different times, both in England and in Germany, he went out of his way to try to find a synagogue during the high holidays so that the Jewish doctors and nurses that were in the 98th could worship. Whatever you were, he wanted you to believe that very strongly. And he, Jan, his granddaughter, I tell a story in the book about a Jewish nurse in the 98th who had her father in New York make a ring for Garrickey with something he said frequently, which was this too shall pass. And she gave this ring to the chaplain as a thank you for going out of his way, or at least not going out of his way, doing his job and making sure that everybody in the unit could worship. And Jan has that around her neck right now, that ring. Yes, sir.
Yes, I was just going to mention, when I was a child, I belonged to the Good Shepherd Church.
Oh, wow.
And Pastor Garrickey baptized me back in 1939.
Oh, my God.
April 39th. So and my father used to always talk about hanging around with the Gherkin boys. So.
if you didn't hear that, this gentleman was baptized by Pastor Gherkin at Good Shepherd Church, which was when he was a missioner. It was at 10th and Cass, a tiny little church. It was a mission church that he started, and it's no longer there, but that's amazing. Yes?
My question kind of stems from this gentleman's question. The details of Goring's death and the executions, did you have access to any military records or documentation? And when you compared, were they similar or were there any differences in personal remembrances?
Right. Yeah, thank you. So the question was whether there were other sources for the scene that I read about Goring's suicide. Yeah, there was an actual investigation that I read through, and a lot of the times and things that I had in that come from that. And then the book that Hank mentioned, I think his name is Ben Kessling, the person in Texas who did an amazing amount of reconstruction to try to figure out who gave Goring the cyanide. But he, that book was incredible because he went through everything that existed. So I used his book, the actual investigation itself, and then Gherkin's memory of it obviously was his own, you know, in the chapel itself. There was a little bit in there that was from the one interview that O'Connor ever gave. A lot of the World Series stuff was O'Connor. So yeah, it's sort of a stitching together of as much as I could find. And if there was something that didn't match up, I either left it out or probably went with the investigation documentation.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, two questions. One is about the letter you mentioned in your reading. Were the contents ever disclosed to the pastor, or are they still, or what was in the letter Goring wrote to him? And second, did he have any contact with Rudolf Hess, was kind of like a strange bird even among the Nazis.
Yeah. So the question was, what was in the classified letters that I talked about in the piece that I read, and whether the chaplain, Gherkin, had any contact with Rudolf Hess, who was sort of this crazy, they were all probably a little crazy, but he was, for a while, he was Hitler's number two. He wrote Mein Kampf with Hitler when they were in prison together in the very early days of Nazism. The letters eventually were declassified, and two of them, actually, there ended up being four letters, notes that Goring wrote. One was to Andrus, and it was written to sort of deflect blame from Andrus's own guards who gave him cyanide. One was written to his wife, addressed to Chaplain Gherkin to give to his wife. One was just to Gherkin. So two of the four were addressed to Gherkin. One, could you give this to my wife? One, to him saying, I'm sorry I had to do it this way, but there's no way I was going to hang, essentially. And I think the third one was, I don't know what the fourth one, I can't remember now what it was, but there were four in total. One of the American prosecutors, Telford Taylor, wrote a book, one of the sort of Bibles of Nuremberg scholarship, and in that he got access to the letters, had them translated into English, and I actually went to Columbia University, where they are, to try to dig them up and look at what they said.
One more question. Yes, sir.
I presume he spoke Hochdeutsch, and I was just wondering if he ever expressed any difficulties in communicating with these people. And secondly, coming from America, did he have any apprehensions, and why was he so well received by these people who had been our arch enemy?
Right. So the question was whether first question was whether his German presented any difficulties, or his non-perfect German, and secondly, why was he so well received by the Nazis at all? The first question is that his English, or his German, he learned German on the farm growing up. His parents had German in their backgrounds. But he also, when he was studying to be a pastor, his education was at that point in German. The Lutheran Church at that point still taught a lot of the classes in German. but he hadn't used it in a really long time. And Hans Fritzsche actually says in his book that they laughed at Gericke's German at first, that it was very simple. And one of the reasons he was well received is because he was old. He was as old as they were. And they actually, I mentioned another chaplain in the part that I read, Chaplain Eggers. He was the original Lutheran chaplain, but they wouldn't talk to him because he was too young. And so they needed Gericke, and they brought him in, and because he had some experience, he looked he sort of looked the part. He was middle-aged. He had, he was balding, and he had a little tire around his gut. And, I think they, aside from his pastoral manner, I think part of it was that they responded to him. Keitel, he and Keitel had a lot in common. They had kids who fought in the war. They had both married the daughters of brewers. And so I think they just had more in common with him, and he had a certain common touch where he could express that to them. And I think that's what eventually brought them around to trusting him and, as the letter said, loving him. Thank you all for coming. This has been...
Well, that was a bit long and a bit dry, but there's quite a few little bits of information in there, and also reading between the lines, you can get quite a bit out of that. And it's amazing, see, that the Nuremberg laws or the Nuremberg trials were to be a precedent for ongoing use of those Nuremberg laws or Nuremberg trials to use against any future leader who would involve themselves in aggressive war. But those laws have never been used since. And of course, obviously, if justice was to be served, most of our presidents would fall under the same kind of crimes, especially with his occupation of other countries, like with the Bushes and the Clintons and so forth. So, but it shows you how these laws were specifically designed just to get the Germans. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow, Monday. That'll be Memorial Day, and I believe we're going to have Stray Dog on here, so... 14-5.